The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. Well, this week we're going to talk about two of my favorite things, harm reduction and stimulants. I've been talking for quite a while about the fact that stimulants are once again on the rise in the United States, that use rates are going up, that availability is going up, and that we're seeing more stimulants out there in the world. And then, unfortunately, the most recent set of data regarding overdose deaths bears that out. So we're going to go back a couple of years to a Drug Policy Alliance conference and listen to a portion of a panel. It's called Moving Out of the Shadows, Harm Reduction for Stimulant Users. The moderator is Lindsay LaSalle. She's senior staff attorney, Drug Policy Alliance's California office. The people we will hear are Mike Discapala, director of Substance Health Services for the San Francisco AIDS Foundation in San Francisco, California; Liz Evans, executive director of the New York Harm Reduction Educators in New York, New York; Isaac Jackson, chapter president of the Urban Survivors Union in San Francisco, California; Shiloh Hassan-Jama, executive director of the People's Harm Reduction Alliance in Seattle, Washington; Magali Lerman from Reframe Health and Justice in Washington, D.C.; Daniel Raymond, the policy director at Harm Reduction Coalition in New York; and Mindy Vincent, executive director of the Utah Harm Reduction Coalition in Salt Lake City, Utah. There's a lot of content. Let's get to it.
Why don't we just start digging right in? Obviously, one of the risks of stimulant use, like opioid use, is the transmission of infectious diseases, HIV, Hep C, and one of the primary interventions is, of course, syringe access. But the question is, syringe access is generally tailored to meet the needs of people who use opioids, so how can we more specifically engage with the stimulant-using population in our syringe access programs? And Mindy, I'll turn first to you.
Thank you. Oh, this one's much louder. Hello. So in Utah, we've had a significant methamphetamine problem for going on like 2 decades. And we also have a very significant opiate issue there as well. And a lot of our methamphetamine users, I mean, we have people who use cocaine, but not very many. So you'll hear me talk about methamphetamines. So one of the things, I mean, there's so many layers of how we have to best serve them, one of them being our exchange model. The population I work with, our methamphetamine users inject significantly more times per day than our opiate users often. And so being able to fight for a needs-based program when we're handing out syringes is incredibly important for us. Methamphetamine users where I live, again, I only have the context of my people. So where I live and the people I serve, we have a lot of very chaotic injection behavior. There's something going on right now with people doing what's called dick rockets, and they're injecting in their penis. And so we're having to do a lot of interventions around that and just trying to get people to maybe not do that and maybe booty bump instead or something, you know. So we have a lot of the party and play scene in our area too, like in the rural areas where people, you know, don't necessarily want to come out of any kind of closet whatsoever. So trying to reach those people is difficult. We have to use a lot of peer-driven kind of stuff to reach a lot of our methamphetamine users because so many of them are in rural areas because we have a lot of oil fields and like steel mills and stuff in our rural areas. And so those people work very long days, especially on the oil fields. They work like 10 days on and 7 days off, things like that. So that's where a lot of our methamphetamine use is. And so it's hard for us to reach those folks because they don't access services as often as our opiate users do. Our opiate users have overdoses or, you know, abscesses more often than our methamphetamine users do. So for many reasons, they access services more, so it's harder for us to find our stimulant users. And they're also more paranoid about talking to us because where I live, law enforcement is our greatest barrier. And people are afraid to access services because of that. So we have to find somebody who's in the community, and then we can start reaching people from there. And it has to be the person who originally reaches out to these stimulant users has to have been a stimulant user themselves that these people can verify, or they're not even going to talk to us, you know. So luckily for me, you know, I spent 17 years building my reputation, so people talk to me. So, we also have significant barriers to serving all of our drug users because we don't have access to services. Utah did not do Medicaid expansion. We have great treatment services if you're within Salt Lake City, but Utah's also a very abstinence-based state. Everybody in Utah wants you to get sober, and if you don't get sober, it's because you just don't want it bad enough, and that's what people will tell you all day long, you know? So. If we're anywhere outside of Salt Lake City, getting people into any kind of detox services, treatment services, is super difficult. And that's one of our greatest barriers to being able to serve these folks. So,
other thoughts on how we can tailor syringe exchange to meet the needs of stimulant users?
So I think this is really important. Paul Harkin and Mark Kinsley in the 90s started to develop these services that programs that are up here have implemented, and the fact that we are still talking about how to work with stimulant users as a larger conversation is really disgraceful for the harm reduction community, and it's about time that we wake up and realize that we didn't invent drug users are the ones who had to implement these services for themselves, and then they had to get. They had to finally convince harm reduction places to listen. And so, like, we've only been doing really focus on smoking stimulant use for the last probably 7-8 years. And the fact that Paul and Mark developed this stuff before I even knew their names, and like I started developing some of this stuff, and they said, yeah, we did that in the 90s, you know? Like, get with it, kid, right? And I think it's really important that we understand that, like, We got to get over this. Like, opiate-focused services on opiates do not work with services for stimulant use. And we need specific services for them. And every single program that serves anyone who uses stimulants should have these written in. And they're not rocket science. It's getting some sort of liquids or food to do to do your metabolisms. It's having pipes so people can regulate their use better. It's actually showing them love and respect, not calling them tweakers and not doing discriminatory language. You know, this isn't rocket science.
Mike.
I'd also add that, you know, I have programs that coordinate closely with our syringe access services through the AIDS Foundation, and, you know, having specific services at the syringe access sites for meth users, for stimulant users. So, you know, having harm reduction groups right there that are super low threshold, like we have a book club that kind of has some narrative based kind of let's kind of read a short paragraph and then kind of talk about how that relates to our life. Or we have just kind of a kind of come on in, have some food. A lot of our services around stimulant use in that kind of low threshold have a really high hospitality focus. So food, refreshments, socks, syringes, and really rely highly on, as Charlotte was saying, you know, bringing in networks of users. Users bringing in their buddies and stuff. So I think, and the other side of the syringe access, I should say, is, you know, really training our syringe access staff to really be able to endure the energy that comes in when speed users are coming into the site, and what some of the behaviors that speed users may have that may be really scary, you know, kind of the mental health 101, kind of understanding psychosis, you know, not necessarily wanting to fix it, but just being okay being with it. You know, people who are psychotic are generally not dangerous people. So, you know, we have to just kind of be willing to kind of be with people where they are, and to acknowledge that, you know, what I find, you know, even in the lounge that we have with our syringe access site, is that the stimulant users and the opiate users, they do okay together. They work it out. You know, like, we have our kind of our quiet side where people are kind of chilling, and we have kind of people, like, you know, emptying out their bags and doing their spinning over here. And I think we have to get more comfortable as providers dealing with that and being around people who are, you know, activated on the level that some of our speed users can be.
Isaac?
Hello. Working with crack smokers over the years has been quite an education for myself and people in my group. And one of the things that's it's amazing is the stigma that crack smokers face, and misunderstanding even within, you know, public health and harm reduction communities. For instance, there's a stereotype that crack smokers are mostly black men, and ever since we started doing data on who, you know, collecting data on who comes, ethnicity and gender, who comes to get our kits and stuff. And it turns out that, well, black men are about half the number of people that come, but the other half is, you know, black women, white men, white women, all kinds of people. They're not, at least in San Francisco, from our site, black men are not the majority. And so that means that any programs that you're going to create for this population, you have to really, you can't assume anything. You have to go out and collect data, make sure that it's reaching everybody.
Daniel, I'll give you the last word and then we'll move on.
Thanks. I think to respond to Shiloh, a different way of looking at it, which is not to invalidate his way of looking at it, is that I think in the history of syringe exchange programs in the United States, syringe exchange has sort of default been optimized not solely or specifically for opioid users, but historically for programs operating in predominantly larger urban areas, and that they have overlapped with progressive states. So if you have a population that's using a drug that tends to be younger or more rural or heavier representation of LGBTQ populations, the syringe exchange programs, as they evolved in the political context of the early AIDS epidemic in the United States, for the most part, did not evolve in spaces where those were the main people that you're trying to reach. But we've naturalized and normalized, okay, so this is what a syringe exchange looks like. This is how we do syringe exchange in the Bronx or in Chicago or in Boston. And that doesn't necessarily translate to doing it in Utah, right? So some of this is about, not so much about differences between the drugs, but differences between the geographies and the demographics of who's using these drugs. You know, and then all of these other points pertain. If you want to reach youth, young people don't want to hang out with older drug users, right, in general. So having youth-specific services, youth-specific outreach, youth-specific staff and volunteers is how you connect. Same with stimulants. If you find that most of the people that you're reaching are opioid users, then you know, there might be some exceptions, but in a lot of places, people don't necessarily want to mix because everybody absorbs some degree of stigma from their drug of choice. Do they also want to take on stigma from every other drug that's out there that's associated with who's hanging out in that drop-in center? I'll stop there.
Thank you. I want to turn now to mitigating the risks of the mode of administration. And so, Shiloh, I want to turn to you to talk about the ways that you were able to help some folks transition from injecting to smoking.
So we did a smaller survey and asked, if we provided pipes, would you use them and would you likely inject or smoke more? And this is, again, I will talk about how not every drug user is the same. As someone who's historically been an opiate drug user, when they said, yes, we would change our behavior, I would said, yeah, I doubt that people are going to go from injection to smoking. And I was completely and utterly wrong. And this is why I listen to my participants and I don't listen to my opinions. And so they started to smoking more instead of injecting. And the first thing they would say to us, like, hey, we can make our doctor's appointments. We can do all of these things. And I think a lot of it is it's the same thing that Dr. Hart says. It's like, if you don't use enough, it's not very fun. If you use too much, it's very scary. And then there's that middle point. But if all of us use meth, we would all have our different middle point. That would be what's our comfort level. And so providing those things, one, drops your rates of all of the bloodborne infections by just providing a pipe. And two, lots of people would come to our program and say, hey, I need syringes because I don't have access to a pipe. So now they're using riskier behavior in order to administer drug because we didn't think of pipes. And I think also talking about, as we talk about safe consumption rooms, just going to throw this out, we need to include smokers on the ground floor. If we do not include smokers on the ground floor, we are telling smokers they have to inject in order to be safe and have a safe space. And so I think this is really important as we develop those programs that smokers be included in the ground floors.
And Isaac, I wonder if you would like to talk about the crack pipe distribution that the Urban Survivors Union in San Francisco kind of did from the ground up, and what some of your results were from that, and how you engaged folks in that process.
Well, one thing that we did from the very beginning is we designed or ordered our own pipes to specific specification in terms of being a mixture of Pyrex and glass, so that they don't break as easily and they also don't heat up as fast, which allows us to enter in conversations with people because they ask us when they come up, you know, what it's made out of, and then you know, it's like any drug has its fan base and, you know, not entrepreneurs but experts, and so you get into long conversations about, you know, Pyrex versus glass, blah, blah, blah. What's important to that? Well, you develop rapport with your community that you're working with, and you also develop, you learn things from people, and you have arguments about Brillo, you have arguments about everything. I mean, it's really interesting because, you know, it proves that drug use is more than just a chemical reaction in your brain, it's a social process. And so this allows us to enter into the social process of people that are using. Most of the people that come to our site, probably, obviously the most, but a lot of them are homeless. And it's just a way into the community where, we've been working to have that sort of, you know, we have our own pipes. I think our pipes are probably one of the better ones in the city. But anyway, that's kind of how we started with engagement, this sort of finding things that people like to talk about and expanding on that.
You are listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, and today we are listening to a forum on harm reduction for stimulant users. It was presented at the Drug Policy Alliance Conference in 2017 that took place in Atlanta, Georgia. This year's Drug Policy Alliance Reform Conference will take place in St. Louis, Missouri. It's in November this year. You can find more information by going to reformconference.org or go to the Drug Policy Alliance website at drugpolicy.org. It's always a terrific conference. Wish I could make it this year. Unfortunately, circumstances don't allow me a lot of travel right now. That will change soon, but for now, I'm stuck here in Portland. Well, there are worse places to be.
Wander into the kitchen. Hey, you're just in time for lunch. Who doesn't want to have lunch? Right? Perfect. Oh, you know, we'll have our own proprietary strains, right? That's the thing about the weed. All the growers always mix and match and Dr. Dankenstein and make crazy hybrid all the time. My boy Mike called me up the other day, man. He was like, I did it, man. I crossed a train wreck with a white widow. I call it Courtney Love. She knows.
Again, you're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Now let's get back to that harm reduction for stimulant users panel. Again, moderated by Lindsay LaSalle, senior staff attorney from Drug Policy Alliance. The speakers are Mike Discopola with the San Francisco AIDS Foundation, Liz Evans with New York Harm Reduction Educators, Isaac Jackson with the Urban Survivors Union, Shiloh Hassan-Jama with the People's Harm Reduction Alliance, Magalie Lerman with Reframe Health and Justice, Daniel Raymond with the Harm Reduction Coalition, and Mindy Vincent from the Utah Harm Reduction Coalition.
I want to switch now from some of the risks associated with the mode of injection to some of the risks that result from different behaviors associated with stimulant use. So, for instance, research shows that stimulant use is associated with infrequent condom use, with amphetamine use before sex, with trading sex for drugs or money. And so there are risks associated with that type of sexual behavior. And so, Mike, I'm wondering if you can speak to how you've addressed those risks through education and outreach, particularly among MSM, but then more broadly for some of our panelists.
Well, kind of an interesting follow-up from one of the other comments. For the Stonewall Project, you know, our first funding came through the HIV prevention section of the Department of Public Health locally in San Francisco. So we've been really, closely associated with this notion of, you know, how methamphetamine is connected to the transmission of HIV right from the very inception of our programming. So, our programming has really been focused on, you know, HIV, hepatitis C, STI testing and treatment, and you know, as treatment progressed, treatment as prevention. And I think that, you know, when we think about sexual behavior, I think we need to be willing to have a conversation with someone about what kind of sex they want to have and what's working about it and what's not working about it. And, you know, to do motivational interviewing around it. It's like, yeah, you know, everyone wants to have the best kick-ass sex that they ever have had every single time. But if that's not happening for you right now and you're using, then how can we help you have that experience and not have the downsides? So, you know, those kind of conversations, there's a lot of providers who are unwilling to have that conversation because, you know, service provision, especially around outpatient and drug treatment, has been over-focused on abstinence-only care. And, you know, funding has been linked to abstinence-only solutions as well. So I'll kind of go back to the sex piece again. You know, this notion that it's condoms, okay, and that's the only option. Let's get over it, people. That's like 15 years ago almost. So if you're talking about condoms only and that's what you're doing, you're not doing what you need to do. You know, our services are connected to PrEP. So we have PrEP navigation services at the Sampson Gates Foundation. A high number of our folks who are in our services or HIV negative or untested, we work with them until they're ready to test. You know, and if, you know, and if they're not ready to test, we work with them about getting engaged in our PrEP services so that they can get, you know, pre-exposure prophylaxis and they can prevent themselves from getting HIV. You know, outside of, you know, for positive folks, treatment as prevention is shown effective. You know, people who are have an undetectable viral load are not transmitting HIV. So for people that we're working with, we kind of do surveys with them to find out their knowledge base of whether or not they feel they're undetectable. And our service rates, our rates of kind of illustrating that for our programming is showing it's above the treatment curve that we're seeing locally. So thank you. I talk really fast, so I'll slow down. You know, 80 to 85% of our folks are reporting that they have undetectable viral loads. That means they're not transmitting HIV. So, you know, we do focus on our folks who are out of treatment. How do they, how do we help them adhere to their HIV treatments when they're using? What are some of those strategies? You know, where you place your medications, who holds your meds, not losing your you know, how do you accomplish that, you know? And talk about kind of the different options. You know, there's condom use. There's serosorting, so, you know, having sex only with other positive guys or having a conversation with that. And honestly, that happens all the time. And if you look at the apps, the hookup apps, people are doing that, and they're doing it naturally all the time. So acknowledging the behaviors, as Charlotte was talking about, for participants who are already using these harm reduction strategies. And then helping them understanding what their other options are, you know, dealing with the anxiety that folks may have around getting on PrEP. They're like, I'm not, you know, like, what would it mean for them? What are the side effects? You know, all those kind of things. Navigating the insurance portion of getting someone onto PrEP, it can be relatively complicated in some environments. It's less complicated with healthcare reform. But the other piece of that is also educating providers and finding providers in your communities who would be willing to give PrEP to drug users and to people who are meth users in particular. And, you know, we have a particular expertise at our program of doing that and of having those conversations. Every single treatment plan for anyone that we work with includes thinking about sexual health, HIV, primary care, and drug and alcohol treatment goals. You know, and I'll give an example. You know, we were working with someone in our contingency management program, and which is a program that gives monetary compensations for urines that are free from stimulants. We have lots of people that are injecting, and, you know, having a conversation with someone about how much they're loading in their rig, and, you know, be willing to kind of have a conversation about setting up a plan, trying out something new, having a discussion afterward about how that was useful and not useful, you know, what worked about it, what didn't work about it, you know, having a conversation with them about the things, and, you know, that moment actually of having that conversation with somebody, people are like, you're gonna talk with me about how much I'm loading in my rig, right? I'm like, yeah, we are gonna talk to you about that. We're gonna have a conversation about that. We're gonna have a conversation about you loading your own rig maybe and learning how to inject yourself. If you're having other people inject you, what that means. And, you know, and with the sex piece is kind of like, how long do you go? You know, are you going for 5 days? Are you going for 3 days? If you want to have kick-ass sex, what's your sex like? What's the sex like after 5 days? So, you know, having these kind of conversations, and what we find is people are, you know, able to kind of make steps in the direction of having the kind of sex that they want and reducing the harms, and then kind of realizing like, wow, this creates space in my life to think about my life in a different way. I actually have the possibility of being successful, meeting goals. I actually am a useful individual. I can make change in my life. I have power. You know, hope is that, you know, what I always say is, you know, in our programming, we hold hope for people until they're able to hold hope for that for themselves. And I think the reason for that is because so many of our systems of care say, you'll never get better. Your brain will never heal. Well, that's.
Yes. Yeah, Shiloh. So,
I think it's really important that, you know, we also acknowledge some of the power dynamics within the drug using culture. And I'm going to do a shout out to Joelle Puccio. She had a really great idea that, like, I feel like an idiot that I did surrender change almost 15 years without doing this. And people would come up and say, hey, I want syringes, and they want syringes too. And there'd be these couples that, like, or these partners who wouldn't, you know, like, there'd be this clearly imbalanced power dynamics. And so she came up with this plan to say, hey, you speak for yourself, and you ask for what you want. No one tells you what you want. No one tells you you got enough cookers, or you didn't, you know, all this stuff. And so you walk up as a couple, and you kind of start breaking down some of that own power dynamics, and you say, you can get 200, but he or she's going to speak for themselves, actually, and they're going to tell us exactly what they want, and they're going to get exactly what they want. And I think it's important to also engage people as individuals and try to support people who are in these situations that they feel powerless, and give them back their power. Because I think the most intelligent and most thoughtful and the most innovative outreach worker I've ever met have always been active participants.
You have just heard portions of a panel on harm reduction for stimulant users, moderated by Lindsay LaSalle from the Drug Policy Alliance. Speakers included Mike Discapola with the San Francisco AIDS Foundation, Liz Evans with the New York Harm Reduction Educators, Isaac Jackson with the Urban Survivors Union, Shiloh Hassan-Jama with the People's Harm Reduction Alliance, Magali Lerman with Reframe Health and Justice, Daniel Raymond with the Harm Reduction Coalition, and Mindy Vincent with the Utah Harm Reduction Coalition. They were speaking on a panel at the Drug Policy Alliance's 2017 conference in Atlanta. Again, Drug Policy Alliance has its next International Reform Conference coming up in November of this year. That's November 2019. More information available on the web at drugpolicy.org or go to reformconference.org. And for this week, that's it. I want to thank you for joining us. You have been listening to Century of Lies. We're a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network on the web at drugtruth.net. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. For now, for the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.